chapter 16, verses 21 through 25. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it."
Very good morning to you. I'm very pleased to be here. I tell your story a lot, the story of the Sunset Church, the story about your looking around your community and planting churches. That's probably not the only thing you do well, but that's a story I enjoy telling. Sometimes at Harding, I think we have all these hundreds of students who go across the ocean for short periods of time, which are good. An experience like that changed my life, but I'm afraid we may be teaching them that missions is short-term and it's over there somewhere. And you guys are a good model of looking around your own city and saying, what can we do here? And I really appreciate that. And I do tell your story quite a lot. Unless you've been living in a cave, you know things aren't what they used to be. The last 25, 30 years have seen really, really dramatic changes in our world, our culture, our society, the way we live. It's been amazing. The things have changed in the way how families look, what the family looks like. Our schools have changed. They face new dangers. Neighborhoods in some places have really changed. I don't know if you read or heard about the story happened earlier this week. Certain neighborhoods in Philadelphia, they're now starting to call Killadelphia. Story I heard was of a 14-year-old boy happened this week, riding his bicycle, car behind him. Apparently he was in a very narrow street and wasn't going fast enough, so the driver of the car behind him honked, and when the boy didn't move fast enough, the driver of the car shot him to death. That just didn't happen 30 years ago. Things have changed internationally. The power has shifted. Things certainly have changed in our own lives as individuals, and even in the church, we sense things aren't what they used to be. We face new challenges. And with all this change, it's kind of created a spiritual disorientation. It's as if somebody has snuck up behind us, somebody we didn't know, snuck up behind us and put a bag over our heads and shoved us into the back seat of a car and driven us to an airstrip and put us on a plane and flown us several hours. And we land, and they take us to this busy street and take the bag off our heads. And the language that's being spoken is a language we don't speak. We can't read the signs on the stores and on the street corners. Lots of disorientation. Not only disorientation, but there's a certain sense of distraction, I think, that's facing us as a church. You may remember C.S. Lewis wrote this series of letters called the Screwtape Letters, make-believe letters between Satan and his understudies. Anybody know this collection? Some of you do. And several times in that collection, you could just read that Satan basically tells his understudy demons, look, you don't have to make the Christians quit being believers. Just get them distracted. Okay? Just get them talking about stuff that doesn't really matter. And that'll be enough. That'll work. In fact, it might even be better. And so sometimes we face distractions about what kind of buildings we're going to build, distractions about what style of eldering and leadership should the elders take, distractions about what we do when we're in the assembly together. Let's talk about is this right or best or not, and endless discussions. We're distracted, disoriented. So what perhaps we need is a rediscovery of Jesus. That's going to take some doing, I think, to try to rediscover Jesus for a couple of reasons. One is, I was just sitting here singing and looking around, and some of you have had even more birthdays than I have had. And I'm just wondering if whether we have been a Christian a short time or long, I'm wondering if we don't bring the assumption that we already know. We've already learned all we really can learn. And now it's a matter of living out the discoveries of the past. I think that's a danger. I'm wondering if the oldest among us can assume that there's yet still discoveries about Jesus to be made. There's also the danger of not discovering Jesus because Jesus really has been eclipsed in a lot of ways. In our culture, you see all kinds of messages about Jesus, where Jesus is about making people rich. Statements about Jesus that are so unchristian, said in tones that are unchristian. We live in a culture where more is always assumed, or I think that's changing, but for a long time more has assumed to be better. And most people we know have this unspoken quest for more stuff. And I'm wondering if we can hear a call to discipleship in a culture like that. I'm wondering if we can hear a call to discipleship in a culture that loves power. Jesus in his own day in John 6 was a group came to him to try to force him to be their king. And he would have none of it. A group of people that says, if we exert the right kinds of force, we'll fix it. And Jesus wouldn't hear them out. The text that was read for us a moment ago from Matthew 16, if you're not there, perhaps it would help you to go there. I'm wondering sometimes if this person, Peter, he comes along and Jesus has asked the disciples, who do you say that I am? What are people saying about me? And so he takes a poll and he goes, oh, this, and the other. He goes, yeah, that's pretty good. What about you guys? He turns to the disciples and says, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, I know. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. True, correct answer. Okay. But then Jesus turns around and says, now let me tell you what's going to happen. I'm going to Jerusalem. And there they're going to put me on a cross. But 3 days later, and Peter burst in and says, what? What? And the text says that Peter rebukes Jesus. Not 5 minutes after saying, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. He rebukes Jesus. Now, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I knew rebuke looked a certain way. It was this, don't you ever do that again kind of thing. And here Peter is wagging his finger in the face of the Son of God and saying, will you hush about that death wish? What is it with you? And death, you keep talking about that. Listen, that will never happen as long as we're with you. We won't let it happen. And Peter couldn't even see Jesus, the Jesus standing in front of him. Because so great was this veil of a different agenda, of power, of ease. I wonder sometimes if our tradition, if there's something perhaps, are we even open to the possibility that there's something maybe even embedded in something as wonderful as the restoration movement? That is there anything, could there be anything there that might eclipse our view of Jesus? What are you talking about, Ross? I don't know. I'm just asking the question. Could there be? Are we willing to at least ask the question? Are we following a set of standards or a set of assumptions that may not match what Jesus was about? I wonder if our desire for comfort, not comfort of big houses, but comfort of things as they are, because anytime you try to improve something, that means it's going to be different than it is now. Better means different than it is now. Different means that four-letter word, change. And none of us like that. None of us like change. A chameleon likes change. The rest of us, no. We don't like it. And I'm wondering, is it possible that we are so committed to things as they are because we don't want to have to rethink them, we don't want to have to restructure things, we don't want to have to change, that it's just easier to assume that we've learned all we can learn from Jesus. And maybe we're to the point even, is it possible that the church is saying to itself, you know, we needed Jesus to die and be raised and we need Him to come back and take us to heaven, but in the meantime, we'll take it from here, Jesus. You see, I think that I'm among a group of people who I share this concern with, this commitment to. I really want to be a member of a church that is of Christ. And That two-letter word, very important. Where do we get our direction? Where do we get our marching orders? Where do we get our values? We've got to rediscover Jesus. But not only is Jesus perhaps being eclipsed by culture and tradition and maybe even something in our specific religious tradition and maybe even our desire for comfort, but there are some people out there saying, pretty regularly now I'm hearing, that the word Christianity is ceasing to have meaning in our culture. Because there are so many people saying things in the name of Christianity that are just stupid. I mean, you've got preachers appearing on television and in an interview saying, listen, I'm never going to preach anything negative. I just want people to feel good, you know, and think positive. Hey, come follow me and take up your cross and die with me is not positive attitude. I heard Ann Coulter in the news, via the news. I don't know if you know Ann Coulter. I just came to know her at a distance a few months ago. Stupid stuff. Trying to represent the Lord Jesus in unkind tone, in a spirit that the people around her who heard her assumed was arrogant. What does Christianity mean if you've got people like that stepping up to the mic and trying to represent Christ? When we ask, which Jesus are we going to try to discover? Then we've got some choices there as well. Is it the politically right-wing and culture Jesus? Is it the Jerry Falwell, morally superior Jesus? Is it the radical social Jesus of Shane Claiborne? Is it the Joel Osteen's positive thinking Jesus? Is it the Jesus we've constructed in our minds? I know Philip Yancey wrote his book, The Jesus I Never Knew. In the first few pages, when you read the first few pages of Phil Yancey's book, you go, boy, I know that story well. He grew up in a church like most of us grew up. He grew up in a church, a Bible-reading, Bible-studying, Bible-believing church. He said it was good, it was accurate, it was healthy. But he says, as I got older, I took my Jesus I got from my Sunday school. He said he compared it to a kind of Mr. Rogers figure. You know, and he starts reading the Gospels and looking at Mr. Rogers' Jesus, and he hardly found anything in common. This Jesus who walks into the temple and starts tossing the furniture and yelling and shouting or telling the religious leaders that they're sons of hell. Okay? He said, that didn't sound at all like what I had heard. And so he began to have to rediscover Jesus. And I'm suggesting that perhaps it's time for all of us to assume that we need to do that. We might be surprised. If we really look at Jesus, we might be surprised to see who he befriended. Jesus was friends with some folks that if they walked into some of our neighborhoods, we'd lock the doors. If they walked in some of our churches, we'd poke each other and go, what is she doing here? And even if we didn't do that, we'd at least be uncomfortable. We wouldn't expect to find them here, these friends of Jesus. People who just got out of prison, for anything you want to name, they looked at Jesus and said, that's our friend. Not because we broke the law, but because Jesus is willing to take them seriously. We might be surprised to see who Jesus forgave. Now, I'm for forgiveness, okay? But let's be reasonable, after all. You know, you just can't go throwing that stuff out limitlessly. Without some expectations that people ought to buck up and live right, we might be surprised. We might be surprised at who Jesus fellowshipped. We just might be surprised if we'll really look. We might be surprised at who Jesus selected as the people to be the next leaders of the next generation. Peter? Are you kidding? And most of them don't even get named after a little while. You open up to the book of Acts and they're described as ordinary people, this group of 12. You know, if you go to the airport and you see an NBA basketball team walking through, okay, easy to spot. Okay? Several things make them stand out. You see this group of 12 walking through, you won't even notice them. It says they were ordinary. In fact, it also says they were uneducated. Not a college degree in the bunch. And Jesus says, I want you guys to take this and go with it. It's just not the way we typically think. In corporate America, certainly not on the grounds I walk every day. You might be surprised to see what Jesus really valued. Might be surprised to learn what Jesus really taught. And there's some text in the Gospels that I just assume, I would just rather he never said it. Well, there's that text like, you know, when your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. Does anybody, you know that's there, right? Is there anything less practiced among us than that? I want you to pray about. What? Well, James over there, he said this to me. It really hurt, but I want us to pray for him. I want us to pray about my attitude towards him. That's not what he said. He says, you go to James and you do all you can to make that right. We won't do that. Because that's why it's uncomfortable. Gets knots in our stomach. Doesn't mind anyway. Or that passage in Matthew 11. In fact, why don't you turn there? I don't want you to take my word for this. Matthew chapter 11. Verse 18. John came, that's John the Baptist, neither eating nor drinking, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, here's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Are they way off base? Jesus hung out with those folks. I mean, that's how this is coming up. You read in chapter 9, chapter 12, all this brouhaha because of who Jesus is hanging out with, we might be really surprised. So there's some text we kind of wish weren't there. John chapter 2, Jesus turns the water into lemonade. Remember that? Oh, what do we do with that? Here I am at a Christian college, you know, where students can be dismissed for a consumption of alcohol. And when I'm teaching the Gospel of John, what do you do with this, you know? What I've decided to do is be honest with them. Well, that wasn't exactly the kind of wine that we had. Okay. But the text says that they thought it was pretty good and really didn't care. You know. Well, those kinds of texts make us make me uncomfortable. Maybe I'm the only one here. But there's some text in there that just, you know, Jesus, I wish you just wouldn't have said that. Wouldn't have done that. I could sleep a little easier if you just wouldn't have said that. So it seems to me that we've got some discoveries to make. And I, for one, want to be a disciple of the man of Nazareth. I want to. I want to know. I think he can teach me how to be a better husband. I think he can teach me how to be a better friend, a better person. I think we have a lot to learn from him. Well, if we wanted to rediscover Jesus, how would we go about it? Well, some songs we just sang are instructive. Right? We come together, we sing, we deliberate together. It's a good thing to do. Did you do this last week too, last Sunday? Were you here? Sunday before that? And before that? So we're doing that pretty well, okay? What else can we do? Well, let's read. Let's read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And dare I say, let's read them assuming that we're not doing any of it right. It seems to me that if we're going to be honest, that we're going to have to also be courageous, and we're going to have to say, you know what? When Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, he may be talking to me. I think we have to take the posture that we're the Pharisees if we're going to open ourselves up to learning all there is to be learned. Now, we may discover that we're not like them. But I think we have to go into it assuming that we've got something to learn, that we are the people that Jesus is trying to correct. And then, of course, there's this wonderful ministry. Go to chapter 18. We can encounter Jesus through ministry. Look in verse 5. Look in that chapter 18, verse 5. Whoever welcomes a little child in my name welcomes me. Have you ever really thought about that? That there's a way of interacting with another human being that is so sacred and so godlike that Jesus says, I'll be there when that happens. Or later in the chapter, this text I mentioned to you a moment ago, verse 15, if your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault. And if he doesn't listen, then start the gossip trail. No. Take a witness, take a brother. If he won't listen, then you take it to the church, or two or three witnesses, I guess. If they refuse to listen to them, then you treat that person as if they're not a follower anymore. If they're just adamant about not doing it God's way. And then look in verse 20. Where two or three of you come together in my name, there I will be with them. Now, I've heard this text used a lot. People sometimes just run to verse 20 when, you know, not many people show up. This text could be used by churches who plant churches that don't do as well as Nixa and Brookline are doing. Okay? Well, there's not very many of us, but after all, Jesus said He'd still be with us even when there we were few. This text has a context, and the context is when you and a brother or sister are trying to work out a difference. God values reconciliation so much that when it's attempted, Jesus says, I'll be present. Look for me. I'll be there. And then you have this text in Matthew 25, verses 31 and following. It's a parable of final judgment where it says all the nations have been gathered together and Jesus is going to sort them into two groups, right? The righteous and the unrighteous. And to the righteous He will say, come on in. Hey, we got something special for you. Because, why? Well, I was in prison, Jesus said. And you came to visit me. I was sick, and you took a cold rag and wiped my head. I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was naked, and you gave me clothes to wear. And if you keep reading, it says the righteous respond, huh? We don't remember any of that. I mean, yeah, we were hungry some days, and I guess there were days you were. It didn't feel so well. I don't exactly call it sickness, but prison, close, but no. Naked Jesus, I know I would have remembered that. What are you talking about? And what does He say in verse 40? If you did it to the least of these, that was me that you did that. And so, if we want to discover Jesus, it's important that we come together, but it's important also that we go out there. In interviewing some of your leaders before I came, one phrase kept recurring, you know. And I asked Joe and Vicki last night, I said, is this common language here? Every member ministry? And they said, yeah, it is among a lot of us. And we want everybody to be involved. Well, that's a good direction. That Jesus can be encountered, not just here when we're together with our Bibles open, but we can be, but also in ministry to the least of these. And I, for one, am ready for all I can learn about Jesus. I assume Him to be a wise person. I assume that because He created life, He knows how it's supposed to work. I assume because He called His church into being, He's got very clear ideas about what He wants us to be and to do. And so I say, let's open ourselves up. Let's start. Let's try to rediscover that we're never too old. We're never too informed. We never have done enough to say, that's all I need to do, that's all I need to learn. There's always more because of His great wisdom and His great will. Let's pray together, please. Lord God, give us the courage to say yes to Jesus' call to follow. Help us to mean the words, though none go with me, still I will follow. And to trust that where He leads us will be life-giving, even if there's suffering along the way. And that in the suffering there will be discoveries. We're thankful for Your love. We're thankful for the incarnation of Jesus. Word become flesh, to love us, to die for us, to redeem us, but also to teach us and to show us. And God, we commit to you now to the very best of our ability, that when he says, come, we will go. We will go where and to whom and how that he sends us. We ask this in Christ's name. You need to respond to this one, not my invitation, his, to all of us, to come and follow. You'd like to make a new start somehow. We invite you to come while we stand here.